This evening, we're looking at the response of Rav Uziel. This is the third in the series of Sheilot and Tshuvot of the chief rabbis of Israel. Rav Uziel, who is a contemporary of Rav Kook and of Rav Herzog, a little bit younger than Rav Kook, a little bit older than Rav Herzog, and his chief rabbinate overlapped with both of them. He was the Sephardi chief rabbi from 1939 to 1953. So again, like Rav Herzog last week, who Rav Herzog we saw last week was from 1936, I think, till 1959. So Rav Uziel had a slightly shorter tenure, but he was from 39 through till 53. Again, through a very important era in Jewish life, the Shoah years, the immediate pre-state years, and then for him, just the first 5 years, I suppose, of Medinat Yisrael, but certainly had to grapple with a lot of issues. And as I said with Rav Herzog last week, and Rav Uziel is very similar, that this is a new model of chief rabbi in terms of, Rav Kook. We saw Rav Kook was basically a Rav here. He was the rabbi of a city. It was a big city. It was the whole of Israel. But Israel was small in those days, and the number of Jews was small in those days. And he dealt with the standard questions that distinguished Talmid Chacham, Rav of a city, would deal with. He wasn't really dealing with issues of public policy, which is what we've become accustomed to a chief rabbi dealing with nowadays. Rav Uziel dealt with not just technological changes, but also sociological changes as well. I've just made a list of some of the Sheilot and Tshuvot that he was involved in. Question, we've touched on this before, the question of changing Hebrew pronunciation. We saw that with Diane Weiss and Rav Kook and Rav Herzog. Question of using radio and telephones on Shabbat, since that was, even though status of electricity had been well sorted out already, this was a different use of electricity. Very much a question as to what parameters had fitted into the parameters of Shabbat. Also, the question of using electricity for Shabbat candles and Hanukkah candles, things like that. So, those are, if you like, technological issues. Discuss the old question of stunning of animals prior to Shechita, which again we've seen a lot of already. Pertinent to today, Holocaust Memorial Day, he has Tshuvot about the remains of victims of the Shoah, the status. So if you've got soap made out of human fat, does it need to be buried? Does it impart ritual tumah? Questions about what he called questions to do with labour, not the Labour Party, but setting up Jewish workforce in Eretz Yisrael, what the responsibility is of the employer to the employee, issues which hadn't really been discussed in depth necessarily previously, as a tshuva about what he calls avodah ivrit, meaning the importance of employing Jewish labour in Israel rather than importing foreign workers. And that's a very, hot issue in contemporary Israel as well.
They have a legislative
Did they have a legislative involvement? They were consulted. I mean, there was the Knesset. The Knesset passed the laws. In those days, at least, the chief rabbinate was consulted. I'm not sure how true that is today. But when the state was trying to find its way, what it certainly wanted in many respects a Jewish identity, and would seek guidance from the chief rabbinate as to how things should work. You know, and then the questions of, you know, gay rights issues, the challenge of Jews coming on Aliyah to Israel with non-Jewish spouses. So, you know, even if you want to have a very hard approach against intermarriage, in Israel, you're dealing with a slightly different reality. You also don't want too many non-Jews in the country. If you've got a Jewish man who comes on Aliyah with his non-Jewish wife, on the one hand, you want to be able to bang on the table and say, we don't want, you know, we're not going to let them her convert. She's, you know, it's not the most sincere of conversions. And if we allow it, then people are just going to say, oh, well, you know, we can marry out and then go to Israel and then convert our wives, and it's not a problem. On the other hand, every Jewish man with a non-Jewish wife who goes on Aliyah to Israel is then going to have non-Jewish children as well. And that, you know, raises all sorts of challenges for the character of Medinat Israel as a Jewish state. And then the questions of civil marriage, both in Israel and without Israel, etc., etc. So that's sort of a brief overview of the issues that he discusses. What I want to do this afternoon, no, it's this evening, is look through four teshuvot, which very much address what I would call sociological issues raised by the fact that this is Medinat Yisrael, and particularly three of these focus on women's issues. So the first question that I want to share with you shows a very open-minded and broad-minded approach to the question. This is a question which was being discussed in Israel in the early years of the state. Was the question whether or not you can have women as dayanim? That's now we've never heard of such a thing. It won't happen here in London in a hurry. And in all fairness, it hasn't happened in Israel yet either. But Rav Uziel was asked for his opinion. Don't know exactly by whom or in what context, but he says actually other people have expressed their views, so he needs to express his view as well. We're not going to go through the entire teshuva, but we'll focus on the salient points. And what he says in his introduction, which I cut off the page, but what he says in his introduction is, you know, this is a hot topic. There are people in a modern society who are demanding that women should be represented on the judiciary in the same way that that men are. That's a very bold demand to make. Nobody's ever heard of Jewish dayanim. But
it's civil judiciary, is it?
What
is opposed to Beit Din?
I think he's referring to the Beit Din. It's very possible that in the early days of the state, there was a certain lack of clarity as to what the relationship would be between civil law, Jewish law, how it would be administrated, whether it would be by secular courts or Jewish courts, etc. You know, maybe they were looking for some sort of fusion of the two. In any event, he starts off by quoting a Mishnah in Masechet Nida, which says, "Kol ha-kasher ladun, kasher la-ha'id." Anybody who can act as a judge can also act as a witness in halachic court. "V'yesh she-kasher la-ha'id, ve'eino kasher ladun." And there are some people who are able to, they're kosher to give testimony, but they're not kosher to act as judges. And michlal hein atah shomei alav, so we can infer various things from this. To chola pasul ha'id, pasul ladun. Seeing it says anybody who can, anybody who can be a judge can also be an aide. So he's saying we can also infer from it that anybody who can't be an aide obviously can't be a judge, because we said yeshe kasher ha'id. There's some who can be witnesses, but they're not kosher to be judges. So Kal Vachomer, if they're not kosher to be a witness, they're not kosher to be a judge. Yerushalmi Ne'emar, and the Talmud Yerushalmi learns from this, Hari Lamad Yishein Ha'isha Me'idza, Me'ata Ein Ha'isha Dana. Just as a woman can't give testimony, that's learnt out from Sukkim, so therefore a woman also can't act as a judge. So that's the says that's the main Talmudic proofs. The Bavli setting us out with a Mishnah, and the Yerushalmi, where the Mishnah also appears, extrapolating from that, that a woman is not allowed to act as a judge. He then quotes Tosfot. Tosfot raised the question, hold on a minute, we just need to look through our Tanakhs, and we'll find that there was a woman who was a judge. That was Devorah. Devorah was a judge, he shofetet et Israel. She judged the Jewish people. If that's the case, how can we say that a woman is not allowed to act as a judge? How can the Yerushalmi suggest that? So he gives a number of answers to that question, and he says, I'm looking about five lines down in that second paragraph. Is there actually three opinions as to how we relate to the question of a woman acting as a judge? Aleph Haishak Shira Ladun Bechlet. There are those who say that in actual fact, a woman is allowed to act as a judge. We don't follow the Yerushalmi. Beit Haishak Yechola Ladun Bekablu Ota Alehem. Mipi Hadibu Mishum Shechina or Nevuah Sheba. Or we could say that a woman is allowed to act as a judge if she's appointed as such by Shechina, by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, as Devorah clearly was. She was given the gift of prophecy, so that was a way of appointing her as a judge. The third possibility is a woman is not allowed to act as a judge under any circumstances. And Rav Uziel entertains all of those three possibilities. Now, in the next paragraph, he says, even if we accept the contention of the Yerushalmi, that a woman's not allowed to act as a judge, we might say there'll be a difference between a judge, a person who assumes the position by themselves, and a person who is appointed by others as a judge, in terms of if a group of people come before a woman and they say, we want you to arbitrate in our dispute, then perhaps they're allowed to do so. And in actual fact, that is the approach that he seems to think might well be accurate. And he says there's a difference perhaps between accepting a woman as an aide and accepting a woman as a judge, but his feeling seems to be that it might well be possible to accept a woman as a judge. If we look in the final paragraph, Meha Amor, from what we've just seen, the Mid-Oraita, biblically, you're allowed to go to a woman for a court case. You can, you know, certainly in matters of arbitration, there'll be certain things which perhaps the Beit Din does need to be made up of men for Geirut. Okay, L'chara, the Beit Din would need to be made up of men. But for adjudicating civil cases, he's suggesting that if you want to go to a woman judge, you'd be allowed to. Daha afilu l'haposlim, even those who say you can't have a female judge, haynu mishum d'medamim din la'edut, that's because they say that that acting as a judge and acting as a witness roughly the same. Therefore, if the litigants accept the woman as a judge, then that's fine. If you say, listen, I'm going to accept whoever's testimony, I know they're normally invalid, but if they want to testify against me, you know, then they can, and I can accept such testimony. So here also, if we decide we're going to accept a woman as an adjudicator, then we can do. Now he makes an interesting observation. Ela Shela Datin. So the first thing is that he's come to quite a radical conclusion. comes to quite a radical conclusion that Minhadin, it's all right to have women on a Beit Din. Not on a Beit Din that will do conversions, possibly not on a Beit Din that will do Gittin, possibly not on a Beit Din would supervise Chalitza or something like that. Because those are all religious activities. But with a Beit Din that decides Dinei Mamonot, not, that if you have a falling out with your business partner, you go to Beit Din to have the case adjudicated, he seems to think that would be all right. Ela sheladatenu, however, it seems to us, he says, mipnei chashivut shel inyan din b'Yisrael, seeing as the whole issue of din is so important for the Jewish people, lo nachon lasot takana kazal. I don't think we should allow it. Even though min adin it's allowed, I don't think we should allow it. Shehi pogat b'hanhalat meshek habayit ha'Yisraeli, because this is going to have a detrimental effect on the Jewish household, the Jewish home, the chinuch habanim, and a detrimental effect on the way that our children are brought up and educated, v'tipulam hatmidi, and the way they're looked after by their mothers, she'inu yachol lehasot, ela al yedei eim rachmaniya, a family can only be properly raised if you've got a kind, concerned mother, she'id sofiya halichot beita, who's constantly concerned about her family. She'in hadin yachol liyot emet, misibot psychologiot shel rigshei rachamim merubim shaisha chonin abahem. And women are just naturally more soft-hearted. They're more, they've got greater rachmanus. They've got, they're softer people. And therefore you can't reach, you can't base a system of din on weak-hearted, sympathetic female judges. Women get upset terribly easily, he's saying. Therefore, you can't appoint a woman as a judge. What is what does the halakha tell us that the qualities of a dayan are? Anshei chayil, gedolim b'chochma, v'amitzim b'rucham. Need to be Anshei Chayil, brave, powerful, opinionated people almost. Gedolim b'chochma, very wise, v'amitzim b'rucham, very self-confident. Shemekimim lo taguru lo mipnei ish, ki ha-mishpat lelokim hu. There's a pasuk in the Torah which says, a dayan, lo taguru mipnei ish, you mustn't be frightened of anybody. And women are saying it just won't work. So on the one hand, this tshuva shows a great deal of halachic bravery. I'm not aware of anybody else who's addressed this question. Certainly not aware of anybody else who said that women, in theory, in principle, can act as dayanim. And then on the other hand, he said that, you can't have women as judges because, who'll bring up their children? It's a bit like, there's that famous scene in, I forget, Prime Minister, whatever, where, Jim Hacker's been put up to increasing the number of women in the civil service. And, Sir Humphrey says, you can't have too many. Women are no good as permanent secretaries. So they keep having babies, and they're all emotional. That's essentially what Rav Uziel is saying. Of course, the implications of what he's saying are far greater than what he's actually written. Because really what he seems to be saying is that women shouldn't be in the workplace at all. Because it's not limited to being a dayan. It's true that you need years of study and practice and expertise to act as a judge. But at the same time, you need years of practice and expertise and study to be a doctor as well. And I suspect, and this might be a reflection of the Sephardi mindset of 60, 70 years ago. It might have been an Ashkenazi mindset as well. There weren't many women judges in the United Kingdom 1952, which is, I think, when this might have been written. you know, that this is, you know, reflecting an attitude that, you know, we just can't let women do this, you know, it'd be no good for their families. So at the end of the day, he's taking quite a restrictive attitude as far as that issue is concerned.
You see, the first part of the argument used as rationale for why women should be allowed high-ranking communal positions.
We're going to come to the issue of communal positions in a moment, okay? So that's that shuva that we've just seen is addressing the technical halakhic question: can a woman be a judge? Technically, halakhically, she can, but it's bad for society if she is. A second shuva addresses the question of women saying Kaddish, and this particular question refers to a person who only has daughters. He's got no sons who are going to say Kaddish. This person is asking before he dies, he wants to know, will his daughters be allowed to say Kaddish for him after he's died? In the first part of the tshuva, which we don't actually have in front of us, Rav Uziel says that really what they should do, what the person should do, is he should take a young boy, an orphan boy, into his home and educate him and bring him up. And the Gemara tells us that anybody who teaches Ben Chaveiro Torah, anybody who teaches Torah to somebody else's child, Ki'ilu Yilato, it's as if he's fathered the child himself. So therefore, you know, that would be as if this is your child, you've got a son, and the he'll say Kaddish for you.
Doesn't he fancy the unreasonableness of it? Because it's suggesting there'll be sufficient orphan children to cover all the people that.
I don't know. There's, I suspect there were, in the early days of Medinat Israel, there were plenty of orphan children who needed to be. Unfortunately, there's always, whether it's orphans or, you know, children who have to go into care, whatever it is, there's unfortunately usually more than enough to go around for people who want. That's the challenge, I think, is the other way around here in general. No, I wouldn't say that. I think he's saying, give them a good, warm, loving environment. He's not just saying, you know, taking an orphan so you've got somebody to say Kaddish for you. You know, I'm sure he's well aware of the fact, you know, you don't just bring in, you know, an orphan to your house so that he'll say Kaddish. You know, it's part of a package deal. You look after them well, you know, in your lifetime in a way that they wouldn't be able to enjoy. That's, you know, in some orphanage somewhere, and they'll also say Kaddish for you. Anyhow, in terms of the specific question, can a woman say Kaddish? Makes an interesting observation. So if we look at the Rishonim, what they've quoted from the Midrashim and what they've said, Razeh HaTorah v'Hilchotehem, all the hidden secrets of the Torah, the whole notion of Kaddish is something, it's a Kabbalah from Chazal. We have a tradition that you say Kaddish. We don't really understand exactly how Kaddish works. The Kevan Shekain, that being the case, Ein Lanu Lohosif Al Divrehem, we can't add to what Chazal have told us about Kaddish. L'Chaddish Svarot Midateinu, and create new ideas ourselves. Midrush Tamei HaKabbalah, by trying to explain the reasons for this Kabbalah that we have. Because even if we hold that in the Torah you're allowed to look at a mitzvah and say, okay, well, what's the reason for this mitzvah? And then once you've worked out the mitzvah, you'll then apply it further. That's Lord Darish Tamei Kabbalah, where it's something which has a Kabbalistic dimension to it. You can't extrapolate from it because we don't really understand it clearly enough. That's, you know, you can understand from, you can draw conclusions from the mitzvah of Shabbat about the importance to rest and to disengage from the world and disconnect, etc. Okay? But where there's something Kabbalistic, we can't try and plumb those depths. Shekol Atzmak Du Shoteha, who... Ha'raziyut u'mistorin sheba she'in sikhleinu magia lahavanat tameha v'sodol teha. Part of its power is the fact that it's that it's impenetrable wisdom. And therefore, where something is Kabbalistic, we don't really have the right to either extend it or to reduce it. Therefore, we really shouldn't allow women to say Kaddish. Why shouldn't we say allow women to say Kaddish? Because that's the Midrashim mentions sons saying Kaddish. We don't really understand why, how Kaddish works. So, you know what? We'll take what it says in the Midrash and we'll follow that. We won't go beyond that. It doesn't say in the Midrash anything about women saying Kaddish, so let's leave it be. We'll just do what it's told us. Now, if you're getting a bit prickly about this, don't imagine that it's because girls can't benefit their father's souls. Because that's not true. We found find that as matriarchs and as prophetesses, you know, they can bring benefit to the whole of Am Yisrael. And their merits will never be lost from the Jewish people. HaKadosh Baruch Hu has given a promise to women that Bizkut Nashim Tzidkaniyot Nigalu Yisrael Mitzrayim, that just as it was with the in the merit of righteous women that the Jewish people were redeemed from Egypt, so also in the right merit of righteous women will be redeemed in the future. And you shouldn't think that it's this is in any way insulting to women. That's, and then he goes on to say that he can bring a proof from the notion of there's a Talmudic principle bara mazaka abba. That a child, a bara, really a son brings merit to his departed father's soul. And how does he do it? He says that by replicating the role that his father took in the world. So only a man can do that for his father. So certainly in the realms of Kedusha. A woman can't do that. So you could ask the question then, I suppose, about what a woman could fulfill her mother's role, you know, replicate her mother. He doesn't address that. But he says that it's a son says Kaddish to replicate what his father did in the world. His father was involved in Dvarim Shebik Dusha in the synagogue. That's what the son does when he says Kaddish. So you can't get a daughter to do that because she can't be she can't become the same person that her father was.
So mother
or father? Or just father? You're right. So as I said, he doesn't really address that part of the equation. In any event, Rav Uziel was against women saying Kaddish, and it's, you know, this is an interesting halachic sociological question that is, you know, pertinent, comes up, you know, all the time nowadays in, you know, modern Orthodox communities like ours, you know, whether or not women can say Kaddish, whether they should say Kaddish, etc. So certainly there is a body of feminist opinion that you know, seems to, you know, be very vocal about, you know, women should have the right to say Kaddish, that it's discriminatory against women, that in shuls where they're not allowed to say Kaddish. But what Rav Uziel is saying, you know, he's not being discriminatory against women. He's saying that there's certain halachic models that have to be followed, and in certain instances we can't deviate from them, particularly where it's something with a Kabbalistic dimension to it. It's not a question of women are better than men, women are not as good as men, that women are being excluded, they're not being excluded. It's just a halachic framework that it has to fit into. Rav Uziel's position is, I would say, an important position in the discussion as to whether or not you know, women can say Kaddish. You know, sometimes people say there's no reason whatsoever why a woman can't say Kaddish. No, Rav Uziel and others were against it. That doesn't mean to say that that's the final halachic outcome, but it's you know, an opinion that that needs to be reckoned with. So we've seen two shaylot thus far, where Rav Uziel is not granting women the emancipation that they might want. We saw a tshuva where he won't in practice allow them to serve as court judges. Now we've seen a tshuva where he won't allow them to say Kaddish.
Because of those gods, a halachic reason so far, why women shouldn't. All he's got in the first instance is a non-halachic reason based on the idea that he doesn't think women should be doing because they should be in the home.
Sorry, which one are you talking? You're talking about acting as judges?
Yeah.
No, okay, I've moved on from
I'm just saying that in both instances so far, he hasn't given a halachic
it's women saying Kaddish, he has given. He has given halachic reasons. But he said that it's anything where it's based on Kabbalah. Right, so that's a halachic consideration where you've got, where the basis of a practice is Kabbalistic, so then you mustn't expand what we've been told. So, because that's the nature of Kabbalistic practices, is that they're so deep and impenetrable that, okay, we'll follow the model that exists and we can't expand that model.
I think it's kind of mysterious, in the sense that well, leave it on the Kabbalistic side because we don't understand it, therefore.
Yeah, but I think he's applying that as a halachic principle. Yeah. That, you know, where you're looking at matters of liturgy, if we don't understand exactly the background to it, because it's coming from a Kabbalistic perspective, but then we have to, you know, we have to be bound by what the Rishonim told us, and there's no indication anywhere that that a woman says Kaddish. There, now, other people will argue and say, no, it's just, you know, where it says, you know, the Ben says Kaddish, doesn't mean Dav, because the Ben, it could mean the Bat as well. Daughter saying Kaddish has got the same power as that. Fine, you can argue that. But he's not arguing that. He's arguing that, you know, arguing the contrary. Let's now address the question which, again, came up in the early years of the state. The question of women and the vote. Should women... he says this is a twofold question. He says it's actually two parts. Aleph ha-b'chira ha-aktivit ha-po'elet livchor. Can women be involved in the vote actively? Can they vote? And bet ha-b'chira ha-passivit ha-pu'ulit lihibacher. Can they passively be elected? I don't think anybody's ever been passively elected to public office. You spend 100 days, in the run-up to any election, campaigning. But so putting that to one side, these are two issues that he addresses. So in terms of the first question, it says Al Harishona lo matzanu shum yisod baroleso. Can't find any clear reasons to say that women are not allowed to vote. It doesn't make sense to say to deny women the right, the personal right to vote. What are you doing when you vote in an election? You're choosing the people who are going to be make decisions on your behalf. That's not we're giving them, as it were, power of attorney, l'darbesh bishmeinu, to speak on our behalf, l'saderet in yanei yishuveinu, to sort out the, take responsibility for issues, civic issues, hatil misim al ruchusheinu, and to impose taxes on us, v'anashim b'derech yashar b'derech iyashar, and women, either directly or indirectly, m'kablot alehem marutan shel nivcharim eilu, they're subject to the authority of the elected officials. V'nishma'o lohorotehen v'chukehen hatziburim v'halumiim. They're bound by the laws that they pass. So how can you say that, we won't say, the women are going to be bound by these laws, but they've got no right to choose who makes the laws. So it doesn't make any sense. Says there's no. It says women have the right to vote in elections. The election is about deciding who's going to be in charge of your life. I mean, you know, modern politics are a little bit more complex than that. That's but that's bottom line. When you distill the whole issue of what an election is, that's essentially what you're what you're saying. This is who I want to be in charge of me. You can't insist that somebody else is in charge of, that you don't have a right to decide who's going to be in charge. He says, what about the fact that you've got women who don't necessarily understand, about politics and their kalot adat, They're not they're weak of intellect. How are you going to deal with all that? So he says, first of all, you've got many very clever women around. Their women are able to run shops and run businesses and look after the finances of their families. They can also work out who to vote for. And he says, you've got plenty of men who don't understand these things. But we don't do insist that you do an IQ test before you go into the polling booth. And so women can vote as well as men can. So at the bottom, he said, oh, well, what about Prietsut? Okay, so this was in the early years of the state, or perhaps it was pre-state. People say, it's Prietsut. This is immoral behaviour for the women to go down to the polling booth. This might lead to mixed dancing. It's totally inappropriate. He says, what are you talking about? If you say it's inappropriate for a woman to go to the polling booth, it's inappropriate for a woman to go shopping. Well, maybe some people would argue that it's inappropriate for a woman to go shopping, but that's not the way the world works. Then he says in the next paragraph, some people want to say that it's an issue of shalom bayit. That's because, the husband might vote for one party and the wife might want to vote for another party. So he says, listen, if you're looking at issues of shalom bayit, then you could have that with the rest of the family. You should say that only the head of the household can vote and nobody else can vote, and there won't be issues of shalom bayit. And so he says, I really can't see any reason whatsoever to say that women shouldn't be allowed to vote. They can vote. His second question is whether or not women can be elected to public office. Says that's a little bit more complex. And I'm in the sort of third paragraph down, also on the second page. Ha-sheila shniyah hi sheilat ha-nivcharim ha-mesha yicholah liyot nivcharet. So can a woman be elected to public office? Uvazeh omnam matzanu lichora isu mefurash. He says, if you look in the Sifri is the Midrash Halacha, that it says explicitly that you can't have a woman. Som tasim, that's... The pasuk says, "Som tasim alecha melech." You shall surely appoint a king over you. And the Sifri learns out a king, melech v'lo malka, a king and not a queen. U'mimenu lamad harambam, and the Rambam derives from that. Eima amitim isha b'malchut. You're not allowed to appoint a woman as a queen. I don't mean as a consort, as a ruler. Shenema alecha melech v'lo malka, because the pasuk says, king and not a queen. V'chein kol mesimot Yisrael, and all positions of responsibility in the Jewish community, eim amanim b'hem ela ish v'lo isha, can only appoint men rather than women. Mikan she'eim amanim parnasal ha'tzibor. From there we see that you have a parnasa, an officer in charge of communal affairs, but not a parnasa, not a female officer. So he's saying it seems to be quite clear cut. Yeah, the Sifri and the Rambam are saying that you can't have a woman in this sort of position. He says that nevertheless we could counter that. We could counter that Rambam and that halacha from the Sifri. First of all, okay, it's the Rambam and the Sifri. That's very important, but it's not in the Gemara. So we should be aware that it's not in the Gemara. It's actually not in Shulchan Aruch either. Discussion why it's not in Shulchan Aruch. He says it's not in Shulchan Aruch. That's, and we've got the old question of what about Devorah? Devorah was a leader of the Jewish people. So he says, it might well be that, how can we reconcile things? That if the leader is chosen by the people, so then it can be a woman. It's where it's say with Yerusha. Okay, like you have a king. The king dies and his position is he's succeeded by his son. So a king, as a ruler, has to be succeeded by his son, not by his daughter. But if it's by a public vote, the public decide they want to have they want to have Golda Meir as the prime minister, so then he can make that decision. That's not what the Gemara is talking about, where it says, or the Sifri is talking about, where it says Melech v'lo Malka. Got proof, Devorah was occupied the position, and maybe she was appointed by the people. Then finally he says, well, some of the critics are saying, again, it's priesthood to have a woman in such a public position. And so his answer is basically, you know, if you ever sit in a boring town hall meeting, there's no priesthood going on there. It's everybody falling asleep, or in modern times playing Candy Crush Saga on their on their iPads in the cabinet committee meetings. But in any event, his point is that it's not a priesthood. The whole issa of altar besichai ma'isha means talking about, you know, frivolous issues, not talking about serious issues. Anybody who goes into a cabinet meeting or a local government meeting, whatever, they're dealing with it with Kovet Rosh. So even though we see that he's been somewhat narrow-minded with regard to women's rights in the previous two tshuvot, here we're seeing that he's broad-minded. And he authorized it. The final tshuva that I want us to look at is the question of autopsies, which, again, for a Jewish state is a big question. We touched on it 2 weeks ago. We saw a tshuva of Rav Kook, where Rav Kook spoke about the Tzelem Elokim. This is particular to Am Yisrael. And Rav Kook said there's no way that you can use Jewish cadavers, for medical research. Rav Uziel, it's quite a long tshuva, and I've just taken out the central bit, which again we won't go through line by line. He starts off by quoting the Nodav Yehuda. So I think we might have even seen this when we learnt the Nodav Yehuda a while back. I think he was one of the first shiurim we had after Rosh Hashanah. The Nodav Yehuda has a very famous tshuva on this. And the Nodav Yehuda says that unless you've got an active case of pikuach nefesh in front of you, then it's nivul hamit, then it's degradation of the defiling the dead to do an autopsy on them. So the Nodav Yehuda holds, you know, if you've got two people coming to the hospital with this rare tropical disease that nobody's really knows much about, and they're in adjacent beds and one of them dies, so then you can open him up quickly and have a look inside, see if you can find anything to save the person in the next bed. But if it's just sort of general medical research, either because you want to do, doing anatomy at university, or whether it's because, you know, this patient seemed to last a bit longer than you expected, so you want to have a poke around inside and see what's going on. The Nodav Yehuda says that's not permitted under any circumstances. Because he says that it's the Nodav Yehuda says the only circumstances in which it's allowed is direct pikuach nefesh. In other words, says otherwise, you know, on Shabbat you would be able to do anything to do with medicine, right? So, you know, on Shabbat we say you're not allowed to take medication. In many cases, that's a shir in its own right. But you know, you've just got a slight mild headache. You can't take a paracetamol on Shabbat. Why? Because it's gzerim shem shchikat samamnim. Worry that you'll come to grind up the spices that were used in olden times in medicines. So, because he says, we'd say if he's looking at long-term pikuach nefesh, well, no, work all day in your pharmacy on Shabbat grinding up spices, because who knows, maybe next week somebody will need this tablet. And therefore, it's doesn't hold with long-range pikuach nefesh, basically. Rav Uziel argues against it. Rav Uziel, I'm looking at the second paragraph. Well, aniot dati ani omer. In my humble opinion, I think shalom atzati b'chol atamim hanal shum tam maspik leso. Can't see any good reason to say that you can't do autopsies. Tinei b'mashik hatav she'en kan chole el Hashem ha'yizdamein. That's the fact that, you know, where the Nodav Yehuda says this is only long-term pikuach nefesh rather than immediate pikuach nefesh. Ani omer, I say, atu metziut shakalt me'alma. That's you're ignoring reality. Shecholim Ba'otam Machala. You've always got people, they might not be downstairs in the next ward, but they're certainly, you know, somewhere around there's people, there are other people always suffering from this this illness, and we need to get to the bottom of it. Vimlo Yatu Alanu Buregazu. It might, we might not know now that somebody's got this strain of some tropical disease. No Macharo Ayom. Yatu Alanu, they'll be tomorrow, the next week, 2 weeks' time, whatever, we will be in this situation. Your example of, you know, grinding up the spices for the ingredients for aspirin, whatever, it's not comparable. You can do that anytime. You can, you know, you don't need to work 24/7 doing that. You can do it another time. But in terms of doing autopsies, if you don't do the autopsy on this body because of the issa, then you'll never get round to be able to do it. And then we'll never know what we need to know about this form of illness. Long term, it's going to cause human death. So he rejects the contention of the of the Nodab Bihuda.
Could that be to do with era again? So he's in the mid 20th century. When was the
Nodab Bihuda was 200 years previously?
Yeah, so the medical profession was probably less precise or as.
Yeah, well, it could be that I would have thought, you know, in the times of Nodab Bihuda, they knew less, so they needed to investigate more.
Yeah, but things were not very coherent in a lot of respects.
Yeah, but I'm not I'm not sure that the Nodab Bihuda was aware that they weren't coherent. You know, I don't know if they knew how blind they were in those days. I don't think that's particularly his consideration. I think he's just saying that, you know, it's really a machloka whether we're looking at immediate pikuach nefesh or long-term pikuach nefesh. In any event, he's being very daring and going against the Nodab Bihuda on this point, and says that it's going to be permitted. He makes certain qualifications. His main qualifications are that it needs to be done in a way where you can be certain there's no nivul hametz, so it needs to be done in a dignified and respectful manner. That's number one. And number two, he says you're not allowed to have any payment. The family can't sell can't receive any payment for giving up the body to medical research. That's a very important observation he's making. He's making that, I think, for two reasons. The stated reason is because there's an isur hana'a from the dead. You're not allowed to get benefit from the dead. So if they're giving up the body to medical research and they're getting paid, then there's hana'a. I'm pretty sure also, of course, he doesn't want to create a trade in human bodies and a situation where it'll always, you know, the poor people will give up, you know, poor people will get used for medical research and rich people won't. Because poor people, the family needs, oh good, you know, grandma's died, you know, that, so we'll be able to afford to go on holiday this year. We can sell her body. That's all that we need to sell her body to put food on the table. That's, whereas wealthy people don't do that. And then the third tonight that he makes is, of course, once you've finished with the medical research, then the bodies have to be, buried properly in accordance with halacha. I suppose there'll be some limitations on what he's saying. You know, for example, I understand that they use human bodies in testing motor vehicles for crashes when they're developing new cars. Seth might know a bit more about this.
I think they've got synthetic crash test dummies these days that are much far better.
I think till very, very recently.
I suspect they did up into the 60s.
No, right into the past, certainly in the past decade. They were still using real people because even if you've got a dummy, you can't. you can't see what's being done to the internal organs, etc. Maybe now with computer programs, but certainly till very recently they were. So that I don't think he would endorse. That's not, you know, that's much harder to argue. That's going to be a case of pikuach nefesh. You know, the way you're developing your new Ford Fiesta. I mean, you could still say, you know, of course it's for safety purposes. We want to make sure the car is safe enough. But, you know, maybe he'd have limitations there. In any event, these four tshuvot, I think, are all representative of the role that Rav Uziel played as a posek in an emerging state. You know, the issues about women's role in society, and then this fourth tshuva about, you know, the needs of a state. You know, in this country, if anybody was saying that, you know, comes and asks, you know, can you donate your body to medical science? So the answer is no. There's no need to say yes, right? On the other hand, in Medinat Yisrael, if you want to have medical schools and you think that having medical schools is important, then you're going to have, you know, study anatomy, and you're going to have to be able to find your bodies. And if you, you know, if non-Jews aren't donating their bodies, then you're going to need to have Jews donating their bodies. He doesn't mention this, but, you know, presumably also you couldn't create a situation where, you know, it's you forcibly take non-Jewish bodies and use them for medical research rather than using Jewish bodies. That would be, you know, an enormous, you know, chilul Hashem, and could be, besides the chilul Hashem, you know, mipnei eva, you know, you could have, you know, could lead to, you know, anti-Jewish, you know, attacks, etc., etc. So, you know, it's very, you know, I think that's the background to this teshuvah, in the sense that, you know, how do you deal with the state of the situation that, you know, chutz la'aretz, it was never a problem. You can always tell everybody, don't donate your body to medical science. There's plenty of bodies being donated to medical science. In Eretz Yisrael, it's going to be a different challenge. Okay, Adkan for this week. And next week, Be'ezrat Hashem,